report from hostile environments? Is your cover blown?
Yeah, you should watch this video I did called Generation Chicken Hawk, where I went to the Republican, the College Republican National Convention and asked them all, do you support the war? And they're like, of course we support it. We got to get the terrorists. And I said, well, why aren't you there serving? And then they found out I was who I am. And they made me stand in a corner and wouldn't allow me to film, so I just started doing interpretive dance. And I don't know if you've seen the Beverly Hills Cop movies where Axel Foley gets thrown through the window, but that's basically what they did to me. And but most of the time, like if I go to the Value Voters Convention, for example, the big Christian right conference in Washington, they're pretty friendly to me and they let me in, and as long as I'm civil, they don't really mind. I mean, what I try to do with my videos especially is just show what people actually think. I don't feel the need to edit them, and they're pretty proud of their views. I mean, it's what partly inspired this book was how open people were and how confessional they were in this movement about why they are the way they are and what they believe. You know, Lou Sheldon, for example, this Christian right anti-gay leader from California, told me on camera that I could become gay at any minute because homosexuality is a spirit that attacks you randomly. You know, I'm like, are you sure that's what you mean? He's like, yeah. So to answer it, it hasn't been that much of a problem.
Thank you for your talk tonight. I was wondering, since you mentioned Eric Fromm early on in the talk too, if you could touch on some of the ideas you got from him, and he's one of my favorite authors as well. And I know that he, on the other side of things, this has been a lot of doom and gloom, and there's no light at the end of the tunnel, but he oftentimes offers some kind of
definitely
other side of the story. So if you could expound upon where you're drawing from, both the negative and possibly the potential positive.
Well, there's so much to say about Fromm, and I didn't want to get too deep into him, into his writings in my book, because I wanted the book to be accessible. But Fromm's a great writer, and my favorite book of his is Escape from Freedom, which he wrote in 1941. After he fled from Nazi Germany, he was Jewish, he was affiliated with the Frankfurt Group, and he said in this book that, you know, okay, what's happening in fascist Germany is terrible, it's a dictatorship, but the greatest peril for authoritarianism lies in democracies, because those who can't handle freedom in an open, democratic environment, especially one like the United States, which is also multiracial and multireligious, will inevitably flock to authoritarian structures and leaders. And I think he was prophetic. I think he prophesied the rise of the radical right. And so that's just the essential thesis of his book. I consider his book The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness, which he wrote in the late 60s, and sort of distills his ideas about the counterculture and the backlash against the counterculture, to be the sequel of Escape from Freedom. And it's a great book because it was written in English and wasn't translated from German, so it's much more readable. And he talks about the necrophilous character, someone who's attracted to death and structures that represent death. And he actually did a study with his partner, Michael McCobe, on necrophilous tendencies. And he found that those who exhibit, you know, an attraction to death are what he called the racists in our society, those who oppose civil rights, those who want to crush dissenters. And he contrasted that with the biophilious personality, the lover of life, and expanded on that in his book, The Art of Loving, which is his most popular book. It's his, ruminations on love. And he talks about two different kinds of love. If I can remember, there's two different kinds of dependence. Benign dependence, which is pretty normal. A husband and a wife come to depend on each other and love each other, and they need each other. And then there's malignant dependence, where someone needs someone like a magic helper. They need someone because they can't get by on their own, and it's sort of an authoritarian form of love that isn't really love at all. So I just think in these contrasts and that he draws, you can see a contrast between the two different directions we can go, and because I think the personal is political, you see the direction, and you can go personally, but you see the direction a movement made up of people, of like-minded people can go, who have these different characteristics. And I think right now, and I say it in my book, the Republican Party is a necrophilious party. The Democratic Party is not a biophilious party. But the Republican Party, with the Pastor Hagees, the Sarah Palins, the people, the warmongering of Dick Cheney, is a necrophilious party that is filled with people who exhibit malignant dependence on leaders, including Glenn Beck. I'm sure you could say a lot more about Fromm. I wonder what you think about my answer, but
I thought it was great because he's a big web of ideas, and I thought that was a nice boiled down version. So.
Yeah, I still need to get more into some of his other books, and I also talk about Eric Hoffer, who's a fascinating character who Eisenhower cited in the letter I mentioned. Hoffer's True Believers is such a great book because you can breeze right through it, but still pick up so many ideas from so many religious and philosophical traditions, including Fromm. And, you know, Hoffer was a self-educated dock worker, and his essential idea in this book is faith in a holy cause is really a substitute for lost faith in ourselves.
I wondered if you'd expand a little bit more on the personal as political, because, you know, I remember back in the 70s, you know, how the they had all the, I think that this whole reemergence of the religious wackos is basically, was a political from the beginning, you know, and that, because I remember all the stealth campaigns, and I remember all the letters that they sent out to people, you know, to get to find out, you know, who was interested in abortion, who was,
right,
you know, worried about school prayer and all these things, and they targeted all these people for fundraising and basically to form this movement, which was artificial.
Absolutely. I mean, they only comprise about 12% of the population, but they're able to exert a disproportionate influence because they're so effective and they're so politically determined, because their goal is to bring Jesus back one way or another. I think our goal is to have, like, the public option. So just one example of what you're talking about, how culture translates and the personal translates into the political. James Dobson has a correspondence department at Focus on the Family, which is so large, it handles so much mail and so many phone calls a day that it has its own zip code in Colorado Springs. And I visited it, and people will ask for Dobson-approved advice on their child's bedwetting problem, on marital strife, on alcoholism, pornography, addiction, and they get the advice. And they're given, like, long, extensive phone counseling sessions, too. But once they're entered into the database, they're bombarded with political mailings, and they're targeted by Dobson, and they're slowly transformed into Republican shock troops. That's, visiting there is how I realized that there was this culture of personal crisis behind, you know, the histrionics and resentment of the right, and that, like the feminists, they believe that the personal is political, and I think they're correct.
Are you a parent? Do you have children?
No, I don't. Not that I know of.
Okay.
is there anything else to?
More context.
Oh, okay.
Years of political weirdness should suffice.
yeah. This is my baby. You know.
I just would like to hear you comment on whether we needed 8 years of George W. Bush to get to Barack Obama. And second question is, what's become of the moderate Republicans?
Good question. I mean, that's a huge issue in my book, what happened to the moderate Republicans. I mean, the answer to your first question is yes. I mean, besides discrediting the Republican brand, George Bush was the first Southern conservative Republican president in history, which means he was probably the whitest president in history in the racialist sense of white, and it's why he had to surround himself with people like Colin Powell and Condi Rice to overcompensate for that, or Claude Allen, who I talk about in my book, who went down on a shoplifting charge after being the highest paid White House advisor Bush had. Bush, I mean, it really took Bush to, propel, to to convince Americans that maybe we needed to seek another kind of leader, someone dramatically different from this man who, you know, really in so many ways comes from the Confederacy and from a party that was controlled by the neo-Confederate wing of the party. And, you know, Joseph Wilson, he's the hero of the Republican Party right now. His top political consultant is a man named Richard Quinn, who in 1983 wrote that Martin Luther King, he wrote in a white supremacist, and that Martin Luther King was the worst person, the worst leader that African Americans could ever have. He showed up in a Confederate uniform at a rally for John McCain in 2000. I mean, these are the people that are, you know, populating the narrowing ranks of the Republican Party. And meanwhile, the moderates are gone. Olympia Snow, the Republican senator from Maine, 4 days ago said, "It's not my party anymore." She's one of the last moderates left. I mean, Chris Shays is gone in Connecticut. Christy Todd Whitman's gone. Lincoln Chafee changed parties and called Sarah Palin a cocky wacko. And in one of the best statistical examples of the demise of moderate Republicanism, Christy Todd Whitman pointed out in her book, It's My Party Too, her wrongly titled book, that John McCain in 2008 won 3% more of conservative Republican votes than George W. Bush, a hardcore conservative, did in 2004. And at the same time, McCain received 20% less of moderate Republican votes than Bush did in 2004, when McCain was typically seen as a moderate Republican. So all the moderates have, at least for now, have gone to the Democratic side.
Hi. Could you comment on the house on C Street?
Well, a lot of the characters I mentioned, Sanford and Ensign, and also Chip Pickering, who I wrote about for the Daily Beast, and that's a fascinating story that I won't have time to tell, but they all lived in this house on C Street on Capitol Hill together, and they covered up each other's affairs, and Chip Pickering actually conducted his affair in the house, and this is a house dedicated to evangelical conservative fellowship and prayer, but it's actually sort of a Christian right frat house. Another member, Tom Coburn, who I mentioned before, knew about John Ensign's affair for 18 months and said nothing, and was present when Ensign was confronted by the mistress's husband, and he said, "How could you do this to me?" And Coburn obviously showed no sympathy for the husband. His sympathy was with his brother and his frat brother in C Street House. And it's affiliated with this group that Jeff Charlotte writes about in his book, The Family, which I, you know, can't really speak about, but, you know, Charlotte's been out there talking about that. It's bizarre, but the scandals just keep coming, and next week there'll be more scandals. I don't know if they'll be having anything to do with C Street, but they managed to keep the news of these scandals out of the media by networking together in this little mafia, and they call the family the Christian mafia. So,
thank you. Well, this story is, of course, not over, and so I'd like you to think ahead a little bit, given the trajectory and the fact that the success of the people that you're talking about and the consolidation around fear and loathing that you've described is only going to become more powerful as time goes on, as long as the federal government, most governments, are ineffective at carrying forward their program, which so far the right has been able to do, even if only by keeping the moderate Republicans from pulling away from what they perceive to be the last base. Could you talk about that?
It's hard to really project where the movement's going to go, and it's a very amorphous movement. You see a confluence of anti-government people who echo a lot of what we heard from the militia movement in the 90s with Christian right shock troops on the National Mall. It's, I think, hard to quite project what it's going to do, except that it will maintain a vice grip on the Republican Party. One example of that is that Mitt Romney, Bobby Jindal, and Haley Barbour, three governors who are going to run for the presidency in 2012, who are very conservative, especially Jindal, who wrote about how he was participated in an exorcism while in college, formed a group called the National I think it's the Association for National Action, something like that. And they started a website, and they said they were going to go on a listening tour, and they listed all of their, their program, which is sort of like their contract for America. And it didn't include any mention of homosexuality or abortion. And they immediately came under attack from Rush Limbaugh and Tony Perkins from the Family Research Council in Washington. They scrubbed their program and canceled their listening tour. These are like three powerful governors kowtowing to Rush Limbaugh. I mean, and we see anyone who criticizes Limbaugh. Last week, Rush Limbaugh suggested there should be segregated school buses. This was after Michael Steele, the African-American chairman of the Republican Party, came whimpering to Rush Limbaugh and apologized to him for merely calling him an entertainer. So the right wing will control the Republican Party well into the future. Sarah Palin will remain a folk hero. But you mentioned the ineffectiveness of the federal government. One of their greatest fears is that the health care plan will pass with a public option because it will weaken what I refer to in my book as their crisis industry. So many personal crises stem from health care costs and health care problems. And if the federal government starts going in and improving people's lives, that's a huge threat to the Christian right's ability to evangelize those who are experiencing anxiety and trauma. It's why it would be also a disaster if Obama signed a bill that had mandates in it that required everyone under 30 in here to pay $1,000 of their salary to buy health care, and a family would have to pay about $4,000, $5,000 for health care, while with no public option to make health care costs competitive with private companies. It would be a disaster. And I've heard from a conservative friend who's a pretty major radio host that that's what the Republicans want. They want that bill to pass because they can still mobilize resentment against Obama while the bill fails to improve anyone's lives.
This is all very disturbing. I guess my question, too, to build on the previous question or comment, is what do we do to counter this and, keep the faith and slow down. I mean, is there any hope for us to, because it's very scary and they're very effective message out. So how do we counter that effectively?
Well, I think they're always going to be there, and they've demonstrated a lot of effectiveness even as just a small contingent of the population. But their failure, I think, is their failure to realize their own limitations and to be self-reflective. I think imitating a lot of the tactics of the Christian right just on a tactical level, just how they train people at the school board level and move them up through government and their devotion to politics. And, they don't fear power, unlike many people on the left who fear power because the left and people who are part of the left, minorities and gays especially, have been victims of power. But people on the left have to realize that, read my book and see what the Christian right has done. And some of these tactics can be emulated while realizing, the progressive movement has to realize its own limitations, within the system we have and be self-reflective, or else, they'll go the way of this movement, which has really marginalized its ability to, exert its influence at a legislative level. As far as what we do, too, I mean, this is a critique. I'm a journalist, and I have trouble offering prescriptions and solutions, so I'm sorry if I'm too gloomy. Well, I'll take one more, I guess.
So I guess in most countries in Europe, there's maybe a fringe element of about 10% of the population. It seems to be ultra-right and anti-government. But here it seems much more powerful. So is this an accident of history, or what do you think is the reason?
That's a question I might not be, that a historian might be more qualified to answer, but this country, I'm not going to really go there, although I could. I don't think I'm going to be able to give a clear answer, but clearly we're different from one of the things that makes us different from Europe. Just one thing is that our democracy puts more pressure on individuals because, and our political system is more chaotic, our society is more diverse, and more, and there's been more cultural tumult here. I think it's what makes me enjoy living in the United States is the chaos and tumultuous environment. But of course, we have like a religious tradition where that was formed by a lot of people who were kicked out of Europe because they were considered fanatics, and they formed the basis of the Christian right. And I encourage you guys to all come up with solutions, because I don't really have any, but I think you've been incredible with your questions, and I'll be signing books, and afterwards we'll be at...
Max Blumenthal, author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, given September 24th, 2009 at Town Hall in Seattle. Thanks to Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio for that recording. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We'll conclude with Canadian philosopher John McMurtry. This talk was given 8 years ago in Toronto, shortly after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan began. It was recorded by Neil Mather. Here's John McMurtry.
I think we're at a turning point of history really right now. One could have said that now for 5 years. The reason I've been so prodigious, I feel completely driven by world events, because I do feel we're at a very fateful moment in the history of the human race. So I'll go right to it now. I've been asked to speak on the topic, why is there a war in Afghanistan? And I could focus on the innumerable suspicious circumstances of this latest U.S. aerial war on a poverty-stricken country, its typical overriding of international law, its strategic fit with U.S. corporate designs for foreign oil resources, and the U.S. past strategic support of the very enemy said to be targeted, like Noriega, like Saddam, and like Milosevic in the past. But instead, I'm going to situate this latest U.S.-led war on a third world region within a much wider global process. I'm going to consider America's new war as the latest expression of a much deeper and wider terrorist campaign of an emergent totalitarian pattern of instituting world corporate rule with no limit of occupation or accountability beyond itself. Unhappily, it is not easy to see Canada's foreign policy role in all of this as anything other than obedient subjugation to this transnational corporate agenda at every senior level of decision-making. And I'm thinking of the trade negotiators at DFAT and all the way up to the minister when I say that. The unseen terrorist pattern. The gravest problem with corporate market fundamentalism is that it is decoupled from society's life conditions. Its entire model is. It is, in fact, incapable of recognizing any value to anything except corporate value-adding, which it is assumed should regulate all peoples and all conditions of life on Earth for, quote, efficiency and maximum growth. To this point, there has been no outside margin, and this is the totalitarian nature of this project or program, there's been no outside margin to this total doctrine's demands or government subservience to them. Since the commitments of a society to safeguard the lives of its members and to ensure that they are able to express themselves as human is the measure of its civilization, this global corporate program is not merely uncivilized, it is beneath recognition terrorist in its meaning. For if we recognize the real meaning of terrorism, and I don't mean the meaning of terrorism that we've had with Bill C-35 and C-36, which effectively say, you know, as in I think Section 27, intended to cause serious interference with an essential facility or system, I think we see the disconnection of the very meanings of words from their actual natural meaning. Terror without terror. Terrorism without terror. They're talking systems, not people's terror. Now, I'm going to define terrorism with some fidelity to the actual meaning of terrorism, unlike our government laws, which are part of this global program. And I would say that the real meaning of terrorism is to instill in innocent people fear for their life security, to coerce their compliance to an armed faction's demands. And I think we see this pattern increasingly at work across World Life Organization. Under the financial dictates of the corporate market, backed by rising extremes of armed force, citizens everywhere are subjected to a low-intensity campaign of destabilization and fear that leaves no aspect of their lives secure. Now, I have a lot of documentation of this, but I won't be able to get into that today. But I think this is true even in Canada, one of the world's most well-off societies. The silent terror grows. Its vast water heritage is so in peril that people unprecedentedly die from its pollution, while our governments sign its future away to U.S.-engineered trade and investment dictates. The minds of our young are so shackled by a culture of violence and demands to buy that their capacity to think is stunted, while their public education is increasingly structured as a marketing site to reproduce students as compliant servo mechanisms, all part of the coming GATT, too, or GATS. The rule of law is cumulatively overridden by transnational trade edicts to subjugate all that exists for corporate profit. Try to find a limit. There isn't one. Riot squads club and gas unarmed opponents, and civil liberties are stripped by Orwellian security machinations. Always the threat is against life and life means. That's the design of it, and I don't think it's preconscious. Always the threat is against life and life means to coerce compliance to corporate demands. Our country's national symbol for the hemisphere, health care for all, is degraded and privatized for profit as citizens are deprived of family physicians by the hundreds of thousands. 30,000 in my own city of Guelph are without family physicians. Corporate motor commodities and schemes now so lay waste to Canada's land and water and public ways that it may be unsafe to breathe the air, walk freely, or count on a forest or aquatic habitat being there in a year. The vocation of serving fellow human and planetary life by one's daily service of work, our humanity itself, is slashed in every life function. Always the command is to turn money into more money for corporate investors or do not survive. Well, I think this is real terror. In fact, I would say it's the very threat to economic and financial security that the government legislation itself recognizes as terror is upon us. But as a structure, the U.S.-led structure here, you operate by projection. You project onto those who oppose you what you're doing yourself. It's a secret to their ideology and indeed their law of motion. The shape of this beast's ever grosser lines dwarfs the monster beheld by St. John of the Apocalypse or the boundless greed of Duryodhana of the tale told by the Mahabharata. We live, in fact, under an increasingly global reign of terror, but our disconnection from the meaning is its triumph. Instead, we are made to believe that the terror comes from pre-industrial fanatics in poor countries. The world has been usurped by a pattern familiar in the microcosm but not yet decoded at the macro level, a revolt against human society itself. The historical maturation of nations after the world's greatest depression and war was called the Great Transformation by Karl Polanyi, but the Great Reversal has not yet been publicly deciphered. Its meaning is primeval. It is the atavistic return of society to an unaccountable male gang seeking to dominate the world. We see this pattern in the 9/11 war. Its public phase began with thousands of people of mixed nationalities, most American civilians, were killed by suicide bombers of a foreign male gang of Islamic fundamentalists. The numbers, by the way, interestingly changing from 6,900 to 3,900 to 2,772, just part of this whole operation and with very little publicity. Each side then duly proclaimed the other, the embodiment of evil, same story. Each repudiated the law from start to finish, same story. And both killed as many innocent people as got in the way of their war to rule other countries, same story. While the gang leaders throughout stayed unscathed behind walls of armed protectors, both called each other cowardly murderers. There is little difference in moral substance between these atavistic gangs, although a megalomaniac rhetoric of each proclaims direct backing from God. Both sides are mass killers, and both systematically destroy civilians and their means of life with sanctimonious justification, overriding all accountability to truth or due legal process. Both proclaim their mission as the work of divine justice, and both destroy the lives and human conditions of innocent others with a pathological abandon that takes the breath away. That is, in fact, their function. It is of demonstration, destructions, and killings, to command by terror and seize whatever is wanted, with complicit governments like Canada's and Britain's barking and crouching behind. The real deal is struck beneath public notice. Incalculably more innocent people in terror in exchange for incalculably more oil supplies for U.S. led corporations, and as a side deal, $200 billion in further giveaways of public revenues to corporations and the very rich in the U.S., another unseen aspect. But the primeval criminal gang structure is not tracked for two reasons. The first is that saturating conditioning disconnects people from reality. It is easy. Just tell the people someone is attacking them and then denounce anyone who protests as unpatriotic and a threat to the nation's security. These are Hermann Göring's words, and they transmit the code of this gang form of rule. Concealed under the most ludicrous lies, its coercion reigns supreme. Already university employees and indeed a talk show host have been unconstitutionally suspended in the U.S. for pointing out the most undeniable truths. The disorder goes to the heart of the ruling corporate psyche. Consider the pattern. Now moving into images of manliness and how the surrounding culture transmits this pattern. The adolescent group mind plots in secret, and I'm thinking that working right up to the war room, the adolescent group mind plots in secret behind the closed doors of secluded forts for control of the rest of society to maximize the gang's private take. I really think we're at an adolescent gang stage of history. Sex and violence are the ruling images of its kingdom of ever bigger deals and attacks on a designated outgroups. The gang's ethos of power and control pervades the larger society with a barbaric code of acquisitive stratagem, takeover of others' territories, continuous extraction of gang tribute, and indiscriminate violence and armed force at will. Throughout group slogans and tough talk to reinforce the bonds of male and servant female bravado in the face of ever greater extremes of life deprivation, confiscation, and fear. The universal insecurity the many feel is, as the resistance grows, played back to them as what the gang is protecting them from. The logic of rule by force is then openly declared to protect them from the terror. The U.S. president declares an ultimatum to the world. You are either with us or for the terrorists. And after starving Afghanistan is carpet bombed, his administration proclaims, who will be next? Charles Krauthammer, glorious name, declares the mood in Time magazine. Quote, America is no mere international citizen. It is a dominant power in the world, more dominant than any since Rome. Accordingly, America is in a position to reshape norms. How? By unapologetic and implacable demonstrations of will. This is as the bombs fall. The extortion racket of the neighborhood is, in a word, writ large as the international war against terrorism, a war in which those who monopolize terror are licensed to exempt itself and themselves from its meaning. Lacking the resources of character to compete head-on, the global corporate gang everywhere relies on controlled images instead. And I think this is its peculiar quality. It's a kind of a public relations totalitarianism. in the first instance. The image set loved most by the gangs, crowds are performed around the clock. Symbolic male gangs and corporate logos attacking one another day in and day out in competitive spectacles, all constructed to glorify the riches of the winners. The never-ending sudden-death dramas hold the many in thrall, and so the actual violent struggles of life and death in the wider world are diverted from. They are displaced onto the sports or the war screen as a universal marketing site for corporations and banks. Behind the scenes, the real action goes on. Instruments of transnational trade and investment, competitive mergers and privatization and deregulation of the public sector are the deep booty system. Outside of the manufactured conflicts of the mass spectacle games the many have their hearts and minds fastened to, the world is restructured as a pay-on-time system where the payments issue more and more demand for all to pay. As this or that entertainment product wins or loses in the Colosseum, the gang's trade lawyers secretly construct hundreds of new laws behind everyone's backs in which only the rich can win, from outside the market, by the way. The new world order is backed by iron cages, starvation, rains of gas in clubs for resistors, and genocide for peoples from which the latest declared enemy comes. But few dare to name the game. And so its order is ritualized with ever more one-sided shows of mass destruction and violence discharged on the dispossessed to demonstrate the inevitability of its rule. Outside the bombing of poor peoples, whatever stands in the way of the global corporate gang's axings of expenditures on life is declared an obstacle to its freedom, in revealing slogan, a protectionist barrier. Any public law to regulate, protect, or retain control over any sector of domestic economies is prohibited. There is a prize for all this, and it is a prize without end. All free existence which corporate vehicles can reconstruct to extract profit from, without limit. In the end, the global corporate gang wages a war on life organization itself. I think it's really a metaphysical meaning here. The world in the revealing terms of the occupiers is a limitless market opportunity for, quote, maximum penetration and control. Yet in the era of the global knowledge economy, there is a vulnerability of this reign of fear and rapine which cannot be overcome. It can only work where its deep pattern evades exposure. Now I move into the final part, which I call the new totalitarianism. The deep pattern of the male corporate gang in its global form is, as David Rockefeller put it at the June 1991 Bilderberg meeting in Baden, Germany, a, quote, supranational sovereignty of an intellectual elite and world bankers, which is surely preferable to the national autodetermination practiced in past centuries. As such a structure of world rule, it is accomplished by the same financial and media system deciders that put Tony Blair in office in Britain and George Bush into the White House against majority vote. Transnational corporations have marketed and financed these political leaders to ensure that captive states serve them rather than the peoples the governments are elected by. Guaranteeing through state plenipotentiaries and transnational trade edicts that governments can no longer govern them in their common interest without infringing the new trade and investment laws in which transnational corporations are alone granted rights, no rights to anything else. All along the corporate media have, as Rockefeller again advises, and I quote from the same speech, cooperated, because it's to the media, they have cooperated with this plan for the world by, quote, a discretion of public secrecy for which he thanks them. Quote, it would have been impossible for us to develop a plan for the world if we had been subjected to the light of publicity during those years. With financial and media selectors ensuring compliant party government leaders, all the requirements for this plan for the world have been set in place for a totality of control of world societies by a centralized global system which is by law not accountable to any electorate or indeed anyone or any life requirement. I'm really ashamed of our government in its submissive role in all this. The meaning of the post-September 11 bombing of Afghanistan may be best understood in the light of this background. What is important to recognize beneath all the spasms of propaganda of America's new war and the forces of good versus evil, variations on a very old theme, is that every step and preparation and aftermath of this whole new war with no end confers cumulatively more strategic, legal, and military control over the world's peoples and resources from an unaccountable U.S. financial and armed force center. That's its meaning. But the war with no end is not just for world dominion and, as it is humorously titled, a fight for civilization. The grand prize of this war is unimpeded control by multinational oil corporations over the world's greatest oil and gas deposits, which are located around the Caspian Sea of Central Asia, the former territory of the Soviet Union. I just remind you in passing that the war against Saddam Hussein, who many of you may recognize, was given the green light by the U.S. Ambassador April Glaspie a few days before the invasion of Kuwait. The key there that nobody ever talks about is 95% of the oil of Iraq is publicly owned, and the people won't give it up. Longtime U.S. strategic advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski counseled, quote, in 1997, unhindered financial and economic access to precisely these, quote, Central Asia natural resources, referring specifically, this is in the Grand Chessboard, referring specifically to, quote, this is Brzezinski again, the enormous economic prize of natural gas and oil located in the region, close quote. Brzezinski advised that in the face of domestic resistance, it will become, quote, ever more difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues. And now I emphasize what he says following that. Except in the circumstances of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat. It's the only way you'll be able to move in on those old oil fields. Well, this is the doctrine of total power, and it conceive of no limit to itself. As earth events interfere in resistance to the unaccountable world rule, military and police links are forged on the very sites of any resistance. Constructing and exploiting the new system requires this enemy to justify the sweeping new powers of coercion and terror which the global corporate system requires to rule an increasingly unwilling world. As in all protection rackets by terror and financial manipulation, the greatest threat to life comes from the very system of armed force surveillance and attack which is said to be protecting citizens from it. Conceptualized by presidential proclamation after September 11 as one in which everyone in every region are for us or for the terrorists, with us or for the terrorists. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick, in a less-known comment, explained this meaning to include precisely those protesting against the WTO. And notice it was at the height of this that this whole incident occurred. Quote, this president and this administration will fight for open markets. We will not be intimidated by those who have taken to the streets to blame trade and America for the world's ills. That's his response to 9/11. Totality of rule is not the only parameter of totalitarianism. In Hannah Arendt's phrase, limitless of power also proceeds from an omnipresent center. In the new totalitarian movement, this omnipresent directive force communicates through global financial and media control centers with Washington and Wall Street, the dominant nodes of the interlocked system. The world's means of life and mass media are the material and the symbolic vehicles, respectively, by which the flows of goods and demand for goods control the world populations. The regulating principle of all decisions is to multiply by ever more deregulation and new financial instruments the monetized circuits of power through which directive control of all of the world's means of existence increasingly pass. The telltale sign of the totalitarian movement is that it cannot stop by its nature. It careens from one life-destructive crisis and suppression to another in supreme confidence of its limitless power and capacities until its overreach exposes it to collapse or destruction. Armed terror is not the essence, but the punctuation mark of the new totalitarianism's meaning. The money and consumption commands channel is the secret of the movement's success because it avoids responsibility for all its failures. Wall Street prescribed market failures to provide for societies are instead always attributed to transcendental forces of the invisible hand, punishing these societies for alleged sins against market laws. It's probably the most dominant superstition in the history of our race. Thus, as catastrophes increasingly befall the majority of the world, the victims are blamed for their new deprivation and misery. This is a far more effective mode of rule than jackboot terror, which is more overt, but it exposes the system to another form of resistance. For such a regime depends throughout on keeping knowledge silenced and repressed. This is its Achilles heel. As soon as people see through it and flag it to the surrounding community, the collective trance which it depends on begins to come undone. I'm just going to give a quick anecdote. The Royal Society of Canada had a really good conference on the World Trade Organization, yes or no, just in Ottawa a few weeks ago. The chief negotiating lawyers, trade lawyers for our government were there, as well as a member of the secretariat of the OECD. And the most interesting feature of it, as I observed them in action and in debate, they are utterly incapable of appreciating a counter-argument to any of their positions. They just blinker it out. It's not a question as they come up with the lies, although those will come. It's just a question of not being able to engage. You're dealing here with programmed people. And interesting, on the street, I then went around the street, and I just tell a little anecdote. And here was this three-level riot police with all in their Darth Vader uniforms and so forth, and these kids playing and celebrating in a center about 40 feet from them, everybody terrorized by them. And I found myself moving towards them and standing in front of them and just trying to stare through their visors, to see through to their eyes, see through to the humanity. And then I just shook my head. When I did that, the biggest of the member broke rank, a guy about 6'5", broke his rank out of the middle of them and ran towards me and went like this with his big steel baton and said, "You're a threat. You're shaking your head." And I really think, in reflection, is not only absurd, this is the symptom of the totalitarian society we're going to, but I think he's right. If you shake your head, you are to this system. The new totalitarianism is ultimately an American confidence game, which rules the world by images and projections of power arcing over the globe's surface, while limitlessly rapacious financial sequences called free flows of capital and commodities strip the world's peoples and their life ground underneath. The evidence is all around. The meta pattern is most globally fatal with the planetary ecosystem, but it has played out catastrophically on the social level in Russia, Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, and Southeast Asia since 1990. But never is the private and centralized financial control of these operations raised publicly as an issue. Nor is the control of the money used by private investment banks and the financial divisions of corporations, whose revenues are based on the generated on the basis of creating over 95% of the world's money demand is created by private financial institutions themselves. Thus, the omnipresent center of the interlocked global financial system can deprive hundreds of millions of citizens of their mere means of existence or their life security overnight, through debt issuance and withdrawal of debt issuance, with no exposure of the foreign private powers behind the control of the world money supply constitutionally vested, in fact, in national governments. It's never raised as an issue. It's an unspeakable. So the question arises, where is the failed global experiment of this totalizing rule by private corporate power ever raised? Where has it ever even spoken, whispered inside our government caucuses? The ground of the silence in even social science classrooms is that this monopolist program has become internalized as a public value set. That's the key. The omnipresent center is in this way made more invisible and unaccountable as it spreads. It's inside. The public signifiers and meanings to it are increasingly ruled out in the steering media to set the public mind lock upon which this totalitarian system depends. All becomes secret in the war with no end to ensure closure against the public even knowing the lines of this world advance. And you notice the newest tactic, which was never available before. We're at war, Bush the other night. We're at war. Anytime any embarrassing question, we're at war. Can't talk about that. To sustain acquiescence in the sacrifices it requires, final section, a totalitarian movement must keep its subjects off balance by a non-stop succession of disruptive changes and demands. Private fear for one's security is a necessary condition across communicatively isolated citizens for their submission to such a regime. The violation of long-accepted norms presented as fait accomplis and the loss of life bearings by permanent threat to secure livelihood are the psychological operations which are at work in any totalitarian movement. To keep the majority in a continual state of inner anxiety works because people are made too busy securing or competing for their own survival to cooperate in mounting an effective response. In the past decade, the entire population of the globe has been kept permanently off balance with one financial meltdown and transnational trade fiat after another. Notice how they're moving ahead with those rapidly now. After emptying national coffers and overriding rights of the domestic self-determination, populations have been so overwhelmed by the moving juggernaut of economic and environmental crises that a rule of universal insecurity has rendered social majorities paralyzed by a low-intensity terror, the necessary condition for any totalitarian movement to continue its advance. For keeping its subjects perpetually off balance is its modus operandi. That is why in the Afghanistan case, the war no sooner seems over than the cry goes up, who is next? You have to keep it moving. Arendt's 1955 study, The Origins of Totalitarianism, is confined, quote, to the only two forms of totalitarianism we know, Nazism and Stalinism. But Arendt warns in words that are not remembered that totalitarianism is, quote, a never-present danger grounded in the endless process of capital and power accumulation. Those are Hannah Arendt's words, which erupts past former historical and social limits by, quote, alliance with classless masses, with the negative solidarity. This is the major, well, I'll get onto that in a moment. Arendt's far-seeing overview of endless capital accumulation mobilizing as an overwhelming social force by alliance with classless masses is revealingly silent in even scholarly texts on Arendt's work. This is all part of the silent collaboration and in complacent analyses of totalitarianism as only elsewhere. The agenda of thought is rather distant rogue states or shadowy foreign terrorists which are ever ready as new pretexts for more mechanisms of social repression. The negative solidarity of atomized masses, that's Arendt's term, which remains is a mental pulp incapable of mutual life defense and manipulatable by any new scheme of war fever, attack the poor populism, or as in Ontario, civil self-destruction. Totalitarianism is thus always accompanied by a public communication culture of formulaic discourse and bizarre extremes. Beneath communication, totalitarianism is a pathological solution to these very insecure and atomized life bearings, which it appears to remedy with a homogenized unity, as we saw in the 1930s with fascism, or as we see after the 9/11 crisis. In the latter case, orchestration of patriotic fervor overrides popular awareness of a collapsing internal economy, an illegitimate presidential vote, and rising forces of life-ground opposition. In fact, however, the new unity is false-bottomed. The civil vacuum is not resolved, but exploited to occupy with the restructuring of democracy by the new order And thus the permanent war against terrorists of the third world is in fact, and it goes on, it's not just this one, the cap of a continuous and historically unprecedented financial deregulation of markets and hemorrhages of non-transnationally mobile capital in and out of nations, leading to meltdowns from Brazil and Mexico to Russia and Asia. The pace of re-engineering of society's economic bases has been dizzying, as all such movements require to keep destabilizing expectations. Within a decade, the world has been made to serve the only legitimate value set now permissible, my particular interest, the only value set you can talk about in public discourse, private investor value, a condition overtly celebrated as bringing a brutal global competition to survive. Well, the most notorious characteristic of totalitarianism, and I now move into my last page, is the a pervasive overriding of the distinction between fact and fiction by saturating mass media falsehoods, masquerading as self-evident truth. In the familiar form of totalitarianism, the big lie occurs in a moving ad hoc form, typically targeting an internal group for systematic attack by brutal persecution and filling the news with false portrayals of an external enemy. The traditional form of the big lie targets a highly symbolic event, the Reichstag fire or the U.S. Trade Center attack, or a claimed enemy of the populace, communists, or Islamic extremists. Global corporate totalitarianism, however, is not plausibly distinguishable as totalitarian in this way. Although the targeting in the U.S. and Latin America backyard of Soviet-led communists to justify persecution of hundreds of thousands of people by death squads and orchestrated military pogroms was a lead-up to the present corporate system. What interests here, however, is a more routine and pervasive form of the big lie. The big lie in the sense of omnipervasive lie is disseminated by round-the-clock, centrally controlled multimedia which are watched, read, or heard by people across the globe day and night without break in the occupation of public consciousness instead of national territories. Groupthink, not soil, is the breeding ground of the new totalitarianism. On the micro level, the omnipresent lie operates through a total conditioning process, not only through continuous television, newspaper, car and home radio, disc and film, mass programming across private and social life, but increasingly against the citizen's will by unstoppable phone calls and messages, ad mail and corporate flyers occupying mailboxes and home entrances, and round-the-clock invasions of fields of sight and hearing by demands to buy corporate commodities. I was on the phone the other day with Adbusters, who phoned me to want to inquire about my work, and right in the middle of the conversation, we were disconnected. So some phone calls more than others, okay? Eventually compounded by corporate security state systems to, quote, put all people in jail simply for participating in a political protest. What is in common among all these saturating occupations of citizen sense organs, it is that all their statements and images are false and misleading as a form of communication. Typically, they are voluminously trivial, with no meaning beyond their occurrence, or repetitions of mind-shackling misrepresentations in high decibel certitudes. And the key one, the key master lie is this one, that the politically imposed, not economically, the politically imposed global corporate system calling itself the global free market, that politically imposed global corporate system equals the free market, equals democracy, equals the solution to poverty. And just on and on and on. Never stop. Questions do not arise in such a total sign field. Indeed, there's no ground of truth from which to raise them, for no criterion of truth or falsehood exists within this knowledge economy. This is its quintessentially totalitarian feature. Across the increasingly invasive occupations of all attention fields by corporate ad vehicles, including school classrooms and public policy meetings, the regulating standard overriding all others is more sales for more profits to oligopolist corporations. In the old totalitarian culture of the big lie, the truth is hidden. In the new totalitarianism, there is no line between truth and falsehood. Thank you.
Professor John McMurtry, speaking in late 2001. Thank you for listening to another episode of Unwelcome Guests. You can download an MP3 of this and all previous episodes of the show at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Come down like an